So I've got the wonderful Les Roberts of the Blue Room on today, talking about the fallout from 97, 98. A lot of you probably know Les. He's a good voice on Twitter. He hosts a couple of shows over the Blue Room in particular. The wonderful Old, New, Borrowed Blue, which myself and Kev very kindly invited on before our pod launched. And he also hosts Mailbag, which you haven't checked out. It's if you're in on a Friday night and you're having a little drink and you want to watch something on YouTube, I'd recommend Mailbag fully because it's kind of related to Everton, but I wouldn't say it was Everton centric, would you, Les?
It's the most non-Everton Everton podcast, I think. It goes off on tangents, let's just say that. Like it's quite chaotic at times.
It is. But I genuinely find myself, I remember the Patriot Boom, I find myself laughing and smiling when I listen to it walk the dog sometimes.
It is all about like the questions we get sent. That makes that show completely because like I don't know how people think them up. We get some absolutely wild questions. Some Everton related, as you say, some not. But yeah, it's always good fun, like.
And if you're wondering what the answer to the Everton-related question is, I'm sorry to spoil your show, but it's probably Jordan Pickford, isn't it? I feel like that's the go-to answer.
Yeah, people have actually started saying now in questions. I think you might have started this actually. Apart from Jordan Pickford, who would which Everton player would? So yeah, he's the answer to everything, like everything.
He is, including who's the best goalkeeper in the league. But that's, for some reason up for debate. But hey ho, I'm not complaining because he's Everton's number one. I love him, so long may
Oh,
stand.
he's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, guys, obviously, this is the second half of our 97 98 chat. And I'm going to talk a bit with Les about the fallout towards the end of the season and particularly the Coventry game. But, like myself and Kev, Les is quite the connoisseur of kits. So, I've got to ask his opinion. What did you think of the kits in 97 98, Les?
Right. This might be a bit of a controversial opinion, but I didn't like either of them at the time. I bought this one. And then when I got it, I didn't like so if anyone listening, not watching the YouTube video, I've got the yellow and black and blue striped away kit on. This is the original one that I bought. It's still massive on me. So when I was about what? I think I was 20 when this was out. I'm a lot smaller than I am now, so I don't know how fit it'd be then. But I don't like badges in the middle of a kit.
I get that. I think it's got to be really. There are some I like it, but rare. I'm with you.
Yeah, and I think they just changed the Umbro to like just spelling out Umbro, and I
They
didn't like
did.
the way the sponsor was like in the kit, so it
Yeah.
wasn't like stuck onto the kit. I mean, it's better than the subsequent one to one, which I think we'll come onto in a minute. It was better than the big felt thing we had for that, but to not have it like a transfer on the kit felt weird. It was really strange. I didn't like the home kit either. I didn't like the blue. I wasn't fussed on the stripe through the middle. Because the blue was slightly wrong, wasn't it? And the stripe in the middle, the Umbro balls that up in production,
Well, they
didn't
did,
they?
and at one, I think one of the photos we'll post on socials. I sent Les a picture of this. Some people might see it, might not have. It actually looks a bit better with Danker on. It was originally meant to be with Danker on,
It does.
but they were replaced by one to one. And I remember because I was young, I was 10 at the time when the kit came out. The kit didn't come out till the 12th of September, and then we went to Derby on the 13th of September, and someone noticed that all the stripes on all the tops, the replica tops, were upside down, weren't they? The yellow was
Yeah,
upside
because they had the same
down as
stripes
well.
on the shorts
Yeah.
and it didn't match.
Yeah. And
So,
the players had like a player version, but it had
yeah.
the right way around. But what I suppose was heartening about, if you look at that Danker one, is that also has the stripes the wrong way around. So it's not just because they've had to change the sponsor. They balls it up months in advance and not realised
Yeah.
until they've launched the kit. And when you see, if you ever look back at pictures from 97, 98, you can tell the first few games because the kit's that bit different with the stripe. Sorry for a
Yeah.
bit of a kit nerd chat, this guys, but it's the
No,
first
I'm
time
fully
I've
into that, but
Liverpool.
like I have subsequently come to like the kits. So I love this kit now. I love that home one and I wish I'd bought it. I'm gutted I never bought it. I had a weird thing at that time. So for some reason, like towards the late part of the 90s, I'd buy the shirt and socks, but not the shorts.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know if it was because I played five a side and I couldn't wear the full kit.
I get that.
But the top and socks, maybe with a different pair of shorts, was just enough. But so I bought this top, I bought the blue chain shorts from the home kit and the yellow socks to this. So I almost had the classic McMurdo kit, to be honest.
Yeah, the Palace win where they've got, yeah, they've got that.
Yeah, I mean, that picture's just iconic. And
It is.
yeah, I probably come on to McMurdo soon, like, because I absolutely loved him. But yeah, the kit, to me, right, as we were approaching the end of the 90s, this is like Umbro B here now for me. It's like, we had like the classic training gear and the classic sort of kit of like the early mid 90s, like the Definitely Maybe and the What's the Story being. This sort of signaled the end of Umbro in the 90s for me. But the kit, the couple of kits they did afterwards were all right, but they never quite had that sort of, they weren't as like iconic or as good as those mid 90s kits. And I feel like it all ended with these two kits. This sort of signaled the end of the 90s a bit.
I get that. I'm looking at you, you've got the Umbro written in big letters. I think losing the diamond's a big thing. I feel like Everton kit should have an Umbro diamond on it. I know you discussed it on the broom. Castor, they might be okay. But for me, particularly last season at Goodison Park, I'd love to see Everton back in Umbro, because I feel like Everton and Umbro, it's a partnership that works, or have kept Hummel. I get what you mean. It's funny you mentioned being out, because it's a real topic of needle between me and Kev, because I love it and he hates it. And I even named a table at my wedding after being out, because we named after albums and made sure Kev was on it out of spite.
<That's amazing>.
My wife was like, it's not meant to be a wine, it's meant to be our wedding. I was like, I know, but I've got to get something in. So I put him him and the biggest Blair fan I know, I put them on the table called B&L, and I've worked up around that. So shout out to Morvey and Kev. They'll know it's about them. I get what you mean. I had, because I was 10th time, I actually had the home kit, the full home kit, and then at Christmas I got the long sleeve, the chain shorts and the chain socks. So I used to kind of mix them up, but Chelsea's kit was the same in this time. It was too light, the blue, when I look back. I think it's a decent design, but, and it sounds stupid, it used to look great like against Coventry or in the rain when it went dark, it was fine, but
yeah,
too light a blue.
Yeah, Chelsea had their auto glass kit then, didn't they?
Yeah.
With the white panels down.
Yeah.
And that was too light as
it was,
well.
It might be, because when you look at it, when we have a similar kit to them in 1999-2000, which I'm not enamoured with. We touched on that when we discussed in the episode, but it's a better blue. The blue is deep. It's like, it's an Everton blue, right? It's not quite a Man City blue, but somewhere in between, isn't it?
Yeah, it was way too light. And it had, I remember reading somewhere, it had like, it was one of the first ones with like the moisture wicking technology on it. I remember, it might have been in When Skies Are Grey. I read that someone like dropped some crisps on the top and just got a massive like grease stain on the top of it, like absorbed all the grease. I was like, nah, I can't be doing with that. I'm a messy eater, so it wouldn't have been any good for me, that, not at all.
No, but I say, I think there are worse Everton kits, but I think it looks better with a bit of time. But
yeah,
it's one of those. But
goes for a fortune now on the classic kits as
it
well.
Yours is really popular. Well, I'm with you. I get why people get kits without the logo on, like, it's the replica ones, but I don't like them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's as I like it with Umbro or whoever made it on.
Yeah, I know. I do understand why people get them, because like they're a much cheaper option and they look decent. But yeah, I need the proper kit, really.
Yeah, I don't judge or criticize people, but I mean, my favourite is I've got it somewhere in the house, is the 98-99 third kit, which I love, but that's for another episode.
What one's that?
The yellow one, Roar of Blackburn. And that one-to-one on the shorts.
Is that the one with the massive one-to-one logo?
Yeah, but like the one-to-one, the blue squares. It's
and it had Umbro on the
collar
as well.
Yeah, it had Umbro on the bottom, on the back.
Yeah, I've got
the
that. That's
one-to-one
that.
On. I love that kit.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that kit. But Les did touch on something we spoke about off air. The 97-98 away kit was the 96-97 one repurposed. But in real Everton fashion, as Les said, Danker was woven into the replica kits. So although the players had like special ones to wear with one-to-one on, what the club did in their infinite wisdom was get a load of stickers with one-to-one, put it over the Danker, and then ended up selling them for, I think it was 40 or 45 quid a pop in the club store. And then being on Watchdog, as if the relegation wasn't bad enough.
People are kicking off, myself included, about the Castor kits and how they look shoddy. And there's that thread on Twitter, isn't there, with like Castor kits getting worse and
it
worse.
It just gets worse, everyone. Yeah.
The thread. But you know, like kits are almost no, like Everton aren't any strangers. When they're running out of socks, Salmon Pink, when that was first released, Nil Sessus Nitti Optimum said Nil Sessus Nitti Optimum. That was stitched in on the badge. So I've got that version of it. It's like the first release of those kits. As we said before, the stripes were upside down on the home kit. And then, they just stuck a badge over the Danker to say one-to-one and flogged them like that. I mean, they must have had the surplus of them with Danker on. Like, again, they couldn't do anything with it, but that's so shoddy, isn't it? It's getting a Watchdog something, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I just remember that as a kid, because it was like, how can things get worse? And it was around the time when Neville was being phased out the team. We were really poor, like the late autumn, really, winter after the derby.
Yeah.
It came in that real sweet spot when everything was going wrong. But as our famous former chairman said, it's terrible, but it's Everton. Before we move on, this is one last kid shout, not related to the season, but I've got to do it because Les is a friend of myself and of the show. If anyone out there has a pair of the salmon chain shorts from the 92 to 95 away / their kit, please do get in touch with Les because I know he's been looking for them for over 30 years.
Absolutely desperate. You know, there was two lads in sixth form who had them. So I don't know if they were on Evans books or they knew someone on Evans books. But every time we went to footy training, they had the salmon pink shorts on with the salmon pink top, and you just couldn't get them anywhere. Yeah. They're just the best shorts ever.
I know. I remember for the first time seeing chain shorts on a fan when the first Dan kit, 95, 96, I went to school in it, thinking it was dead cool, and I saw some kid in the blue shorts, couldn't get out of my head for weeks. I was like, I want the chain shorts. I don't know why I want them. But yeah, moving on to kind of the fallout, 97, 98. Just want to talk a little bit of the build-up to Coventry and whatnot. I mean, when you look at it, Les, we won two of the last 15 games. So the fact we were down there, it wasn't a surprise because it wasn't just that we weren't winning games. It's the way we were playing as well in the build-up, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was dreadful. We were on an absolutely shocking run. Sort of the immediate build-up to that game, so the game before was Arsenal away, wasn't it?
Well, David Feely said, in all his years going to watch Everton, that's the worst. He said that was the deal.
Yeah, I was watching that in a pub down south, not in London, sort of a bit further out, but down south somewhere, I can't remember where, and it was just full of teleclap on Arsenal fans, and I was the only toffee in there, and to watch that sort of, I was watching it on my own as well because people were down with no one was into footy, so no one came with me, so I just went and watched it on my own, and it was just like a very very lonely 90 minutes of football, and to you know to see them just rip us apart, which they've done in subsequent seasons.
Yeah,
but this one felt like as bad as anything because we were on such a bad run. I don't think anyone was expecting anything out the game, but it felt like we needed something out the game.
Yeah,
and then like to just get ripped apart by them like that, and then to have Tony Adams just sort of stroll through and absolutely lash one.
How much space has he got when he does that?
In for the fourth,
I can't go around much space he has when you see that go back. I mean, I turn it off whenever it comes on telly because I'm a bit younger than Les. I remember we were talking about me having the kit. I went through a little phase because I was 11 at the time of maybe wearing kits to match what they're wearing. So I was wearing all blue with the short sleeves. I remember sitting there in my living room at home just crying my eyes out because I was like, we're gone. We're absolutely finished.
Yeah, that was the feeling. We did feel like that was it. It was sort of because we were in such a terminal tailspin. And bear in mind, this is the first time this had happened since 94,
yeah,
which seemed like a blip. So the thing about 94, and this was the difference between the two sort of last day relegation escapes, 94 came 7 years after we'd won the title. This felt like a blip to us. It was like we were always on a decline and we had gone a bit shit, but we never thought we'd gone that shit. So it was like, yeah, this won't happen again. That was the thing after the Wimbledon game. It'll never happen again. No chance. Obviously, it did a few years later. But, you know, a lot of time had passed at that point. They'd not been very good at all during the 90s. Obviously, we won the FA Cup. But there'd been a lot of hassle with Peter Johnson. The club wasn't being run well. The Park End, you know, the Park End that we know and love, it was a second-rate stand that had been built with relegation in mind. So I think leading up to 98, it felt a lot more like a club in decline. It was then 10 years or more since we won the title. And the atmosphere around the club was very different. So, if you like, I know we've kind of not become accustomed to it the last few seasons, but we have kind of got used to it a bit. So, although every season it's got an impact, nothing will be like the impact of that one for me because it felt like, yeah, this is a club really in bad decline here.
Yeah.
And if we go, we're doomed. And there's a really good chance we're going to go because the team was playing really badly. As you say, the run we were on was awful. And Coventry were a good side at the time.
Beware, they survived on the last day of the previous season, but they kicked on a bit under Gordon Strachan in his first job.
Yeah.
You had players like Roland Nielsen was a good player. You had Dion Dublin, who obviously famously basically cost Howard his job on the second.
Yeah.
You had Darren Huckabee, I've discussed on the pod, wasn't a player I was a fan of, but he was fast. He was really
rapid.
Yeah. They had some dangerous players. Gary McAllister, who comes up too much on this pod, but he was still
Was Stephen Froggatt there at that point?
No, he joined them the first half of 1999, when, just before he scored that goal against us.
I was going to say, because
Yeah.
he scored the Rashford
That was in the
against
kit I
us.
was saying, the kit that I loved, that was that one on the
Oh, yeah, of
yeah,
course.
on the Super Sunday, we got battered there down there. Yeah. I've heard you say on previous pods when when you've discussed this, or maybe when I've had a chat with you in the Denby, they all blur into one, as your company is so
Yeah.
enjoyable. Well, I think one of the really good points you've made for maybe some of our younger or more modern listeners is 98 feels a bit more like Bournemouth in the way that 94 feels a bit like Palace in 2022.
Yeah.
When in 2022 and 1994, there's kind of I was at Wimbledon 94, but I was 7 years of age, probably a bit too young to really appreciate it. As we're telling David when I interviewed him, I was in the middle of reading a Batman comic that my dad had got me. So I was very excited with that, not realizing people were screaming around me. It's another passion me and Les share, but we'll come to that off here. We won't bore the listeners. And basically, but I remember 98, how horrible the atmosphere was. And I do think that was really like the Bournemouth one where people were relieved against Palace, against Bournemouth. Yeah, there was an element of relief, but the chance against the ball started like as soon as the final whistle went, didn't he?
Yeah, it was. And as you say, it was the same against Coventry. I think it's because it was that never again thing with Wimbledon and Crystal Palace. So, I mean, with hindsight, Frank Lampard was a dreadful manager. We were very lucky to stay up. I don't know how we did. But I think after that, leading up to that Palace game, it was nerve-wracking. We obviously had the extra chance that we could still get beat and stay up. It wasn't the end of the world if we got
No.
beat, but we didn't want to go into that Arsenal game needing anything, so we kind of had to get something from it.
Yeah.
But leading up to that, I felt like, you know what, if we just get through this game, because I think at that point it was that I was still blaming Benitez for everything.
Yeah, I
But
still am kind of, you
oh
know.
yeah, I still do, right? But it
It
kind of clouded how bad Lampard was, I think, because it was all like, we
did,
just
yeah.
get through this, we'll be sound after that, we'll be all right, so we just got to get through this. We did, and the way we did it, which was very Wimbledon-esque, it was like freakily similar. That element of relief, and it was just a really like grandstanding way to win, wasn't it? We mad at very un-Everton, but we've gone and done it twice there, a couple of decades apart. But yeah, as you say, leading up to Coventry and the Bournemouth game, things hadn't got better, and the atmosphere was very much one against the board. I remember after the Coventry game, me and my dad were in the main stand for that game. I didn't have a season ticket that year, I was still at uni. And had my Saturday job, so the games I could get to were kind of a bit few and far between. So I was in the main stand for that game, and there was a lot of vitriol going towards. We were quite close to the executive, the director's box and that. And as they were walking out, there was a lot of anger aimed towards them. And there was people on the pitch at the end of that one, wasn't there? Not in a celebratory way like Wimbledon, but really going straight for that director's box to tell them what they thought about it. And yeah, it was a really strange one, wasn't it? Because you probably spoke about this like earlier on in the pod, but we got Howard Kendall that summer back as manager, and this is when Peter Johnson was saying we're going to get it. There was someone being pleasantly surprised, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When he said that in the summer, he was like, I think we went after Andy Gray. He's like, we're going to get it. Oh, was that the season after?
No, we
That was
got
that
after
season, wasn't it?
Gray. I spoke with this David Feely because he made the point that, and it was something I did when I was doing a bit, even though obviously we go off our memories, do a bit of research for the pod. Johnson literally came out and said, we'll get a world-class manager. And there was talk of
Yeah.
Johan Cruyff, Bobby Robson. Gray was like,
Bobby.
Gray, there was a flirtation for quite a while where it looked like Gray was going to get the.
Yeah.
And then one day it was like, Howard's back.
Well, that was the thing. Yeah. So leading up to that, he had said, because we weren't left in that much of a bad position when Joe Royal left. The team was still all right, but it
We
wasn't
were in a
great.
funk, but we had an okay squad, didn't we? Yeah.
We were definitely on the decline. But yeah, I remember chasing Bobby Robson for a long time during the summer, and he kind of led us a bit of a dance for the third time. He
Yeah.
sort of said, yeah, do you know what, I'm interested, and then just jibbed us
He
off.
was getting messed around at Barcelona, wasn't he? He'd been there with Ronaldo, and then they like
Yeah.
want you to work above Van Gaal. So I think it was
So
kind
there
of
was,
getting back at them a little bit, wasn't it?
yeah, there was a lot of expectation there. And then so to get Howard Kendall in again, I think he was at Sheffield United at the time.
Yeah, they just
I
lost the playoff
think,
final. Don Hutchison got injured,
yeah,
didn't he?
it was because he'd not done it the second time, it was like, well, he's never going to do it the third time. So it did feel like, when it came to the Coventry game, the atmosphere was very much like, yeah, this club's a bit screwed here, because we couldn't attract the manager. We ended up going back to Howard Kendall the third time. We've been terrible all season. I mean, a little bit of a shout out to Mick Matarda here, because he wasn't quite Kevin Campbell, but he did come in towards the back end of that season, score some vital goals.
He
Missed sitting in the derby, which
he
he'll never be forgiven for.
He did, but he scored some big goals. Like the one, I don't know, I remember it so well. It's not a classic goal because I think it's bad goalkeeping, but I love the one against Blackburn, Joe, where he like challenges Tim Flowers and it kind of, it was John Spencer's debut, which I mean, I've discussed this in the pod. It was one of my
I forgot we had John Spencer.
it was one of my favourite Everton games. We had the day out with my dad and stuff. I just had a really good day. And I remember that. And I remember my dad was scoring goals, but kind of going off tangent a little bit. Do you remember? I know you said you were going to the game a bit more sporadically. Do you remember a couple of weeks later when we lost 4-1 to Villa, but the scoreboard in the Park End was broken? It said Everton 4, Villa 1, when it was the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And someone ran on the pitch to front the ref.
that scoreboard, it was an absolute relic, wasn't it? I think Trammy have got it now. Well, Trammy did
say, I live in Oxnard. We're literally a stone's throw from Prenton Park, so I'll go down and check it one night when I'm walking the dog to see.
they definitely did have it at some point, but that, as you say, that running leading up to that, we beat Leeds and we beat Blackburn, as you say.
Leeds was a really good performance, but did you get a chance? You were saying before, with you obviously job and being a student, did you get a chance to go to the Sheffield Wed game, just the last Tottenham game before the Coventry one?
No, I missed that, but that really did feel like, so I obviously talked about the Arsenal game, that Sheffield Wednesday game, again, they weren't a bad team at the time, they were all right, but they ripped us apart.
Di Canio was brilliant that day, but Mark Pembroke scored twice, which I think says an awful lot, because we all know quite what his qualities aren't, if of a certain vintage. And also, I just remember from that day, even I was young, my dad made a boss point. They didn't read the scores out from the other games after the game. Joe, they used to announce
did they not?
No. So it's like they knew this isn't going well. We're not going to tell the Bolton score or whatever it is. It was a bit ugly, although I do, in retrospect, appreciate Gavin McCann just booting Di Canio after he scored for no good reason. Just like, I might as well boot him. Also, sorry for me being a stat nerd. It's the first game there was ever a yellow ball in the English league. They piloted that game for some reason. I remember seeing on Soccer M the day, so we have a look at photos from that game.
Yeah.
Yellow ball was the first time they piloted the use of it. So that's why I had to meet my wife on the internet, guys. Full useless knowledge.
See, you don't get this on any other podcast at all. You don't. That's what we want. We want information like that. This is pub quiz stuff. Just going back to the scores, getting read out. That was the big thing, obviously, about the Coventry game. The scores going round that, Chelsea were beating Bolton 2-0. And, I don't think the scores were put up on the scoreboard like they normally are. It was left to people with a transistor radio, because obviously no phones in them then. Yeah. We did have some mobile phones, but they were massive.
Yeah, and you wouldn't get, you still don't get signal now anyway. Yeah. But
it was people with radios.
Well, when you watch, if you ever watch the Premier League games, you just see people, don't you? Like there's a fact, with holding on. I remember I was in the paddock, and I end up on the pitch. My dad didn't protest. I was 11 years of age, so I think just the chance to run on was kind of exciting.
Yeah.
I remember looking at this woman behind me. I was like, have we stayed up? And she was like, she was nodding, going, yeah, we've stayed up. And I touched on this with Dave Feely. One of the biggest thank yous I owe my mum is, in the week building up to the Coventry game, my dad actually said to me, I'm sorry to repeat this a bit through the pod, he said to me, mum, I don't think I want to take him. Not because, just because I love him, and I don't want him to see this. And because you said you went at the time. Did you go on a season ticket or just on general tickets when you went?
Just on general.
Yeah.
The season ticket
used to be in a book. And I remember my dad pointing as we went in, they had an advert for Telewest. Do you remember the cable company?
Yeah.
And it said, watch all your Premier League football here. And I just remember my dad pointing at it and being like, what good's that to us? Like genuinely.
God, yeah, these some adverts in the back of the book.
Yeah, what's the use of that to us? And the programme was Dixie 60, wasn't it? Because it was like, it was the 70th anniversary of Dixie 60.
It was, down the Park End as well.
Yeah, I've got a big collection of programmes, but that one just got battered that day because we ended up in a pub on County Road singing Gareth Barry's name. In terms of obviously the fallout, you spoke a bit about how nasty it was. How did you feel about the actual game itself, Les, during the game?
I remember it was absolutely lashing down, wasn't it?
Oh, it was terrible.
It was a horrible, horrible day. Gareth Farrell, I mean, again, there was, there was, like we said, with Crystal Palace and Wimbledon, there was comparisons between Wimbledon and Coventry, because Gareth Farrell, he shinned it a little bit, but it's a lovely goal.
Oh, it's a beauty, isn't it? On a swing,
which came from nowhere, because he'd been as bad that season as Barry Orme was that 93-94 season. So that just came from nowhere, for him to become like an Everton hero, really. It was nice because he seems like a sound fella, to be honest.
Yeah, I know a few people who know him through work and stuff, and he seems like a really nice fella. But just a quick one, sorry to keep up bringing dad. I would, I'm going to blame, well, credit him for that goal, because he used to put a pound every week on Farrelly first goal. And he didn't do it that week, the one week he did.
Christ, if he was in a bad mood going in, that must have tipped him over the edge.
No, I think he was quite content with the goal. And we get a bit of a controversial pen, don't we? Just for the listeners, I did end up wearing Nick Barnby's shirt and he misses this pen in my stag, but it's probably a bit of justice because I don't think it was a pen.
I don't think it was a penalty, but you know, at that point, to put us 2-0 up, we were like, yeah, go ahead. And Nick Barnby had been decent for us up until this point as well, but yeah, that was when we should have known. The writing was on the wall there, yeah, when he missed that penalty.
This is what we're dealing with. And I mean, as a game, we don't play terribly in it, but I think Thomas Mahon is a good goalie, but he's just got to try and parry that header from Dublin, hasn't he?
He tries to catch it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, as we said, it was absolutely lashing down. And Dion Dublin gets a header in, doesn't he? And he dives to his left. Both goals were down the park end, weren't they?
They were, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Dives to his left to try and catch it, and it just slips through his hand. And then, obviously, we're all on edge then, because, you know, if Bolton get any sort of results, they stay up.
Well, Chelsea fans are cheering them on, aren't they?
Yeah,
you know, and one of the things that if you ever watch Premier League or Premier League, whatever it's called in that respect, when you watch this game, they have a montage of both the games with Angels playing, because that was a big hit that year. And all the Chelsea fans are egging Bolton on, and they've got a shadow side up, because they've got the Cup Winners' Cup final later that week, but because they're pros, they go up the other end. Jody Morris makes it 2-0, but it cuts to Andy Gray in Goodison Park, and he's co-coms, and he goes, it doesn't matter what happened to Chelsea, because their game finished slightly earlier. We had 2 minutes of injury time left. He goes, because if Everton concede, they're down. He went, Howard Kendall's about to endure 2 minutes of unbelievable pressure. And when you think,
oh, yeah, that was it, because we stayed up on goal difference, didn't we?
Five goals. I think there's five goals in it or something mad like that.
Yeah. And obviously, you get the Bolton fans talking about that first game with the Reebok.
Yeah.
Teddy Phelan heads it off the line, sort of. Southall was fouled in the build-up.
Nathan Blake fouled Southall. That's the way I look at it. I do remember the Sky Sports and build-up being like, if this goal had been allowed, this would need to be
test. It was a foul. Just on that, I don't know if you touched on it, but Dave, but you know, like that was the first game at the Reebok. That was the first ever game at the Reebok.
Yeah.
So Bolton had the first game at Goodison, didn't they?
Did they? I never knew that. Thank you. Well, this is what this pod's about, Les. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Bolton played the first game at Goodison. It was an exhibition match in Everton, 1-4-2. But yeah, the first ever match at Goodison Park with Everton v Bolton.
Well,
so there's a nice bit of symmetry there as well.
There is. I've got a friend of a friend who's a Bolton fan, seen him a few years, but he used to be quite bitter about this.
I
used to remind him, talking of symmetry, when they came back up in 2001, they won the playoff final 3-0. Who scored the first goal?
Who was it?
Gareth Farrelly.
Oh, there you go. Look at that.
Everything's connected.
It is. It's like a Matrix, man.
It's mad. So, yeah, obviously, there was a bit of tension around the ground. You said it was quite vitriolic. Celebrate the wrong word, and I touched on this with Dave. I don't think we should be celebrating days like this, but there's a lot of emotion in the moment, isn't there? And, you know, it's big on the day. What did you do after that? Did you go for a pint? Did you, or did you just go around, or just go home and like turn the lights off?
Just went home.
Yeah.
Just went home after. So, yeah, I was with my dad. So, yeah, we did. Our match routine then was pretty much just like get in the game for kickoff and go home after. So, it wasn't really a big thing going for a bet, because I didn't get to too many games and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we just went home after, which is, you know, quite uneventful, because but I don't think it'd have been in the mood to do anything anyway.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't that sort of celebratory thing. It was a really horrible atmosphere. Yeah, like you say, like Bournemouth.
I agree with you. I remember seeing you in the Denby after the Bournemouth game. We had a bit of a chat, and you'd done the Blue Room, and the comparison was, people went for a pint, but people weren't like, let's stay out and get bevied all night. People were like, I just need a couple of pints and then slink off home to bed. This is because I think sadly, because we've not won much, sometimes people see it, these, not everyone, but some people might see it as a celebration, and it's not. It's just an outpouring relief, in my opinion. People are just worried about it for weeks and weeks in the build up, and it just comes out in one day.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those things. Unless you've been in that position, you're not in a position to judge. Basically,
no, not at all, not at all.
Because it's not, obviously, it's not like winning something, but the sense of, as you say, relief you get from it, and it is a feeling of euphoria sometimes. Like as you say, in this instance, it wasn't. But when it is, it's such a weird feeling. It's
It
such a
is.
mixed feeling.
It is because it's
And
like.
the flip side as well, sorry, is like in instances like this, when you do stay up and you don't have that sort of euphoria, it then comes out as anger. So you've got the relief, which is then turns to anger. Sound like a Jedi here. You get the relief, which then turns to anger, whereas, in other circumstances, you just get dead happy about it. So it's a horrible situation to be in, and we've been in it too many times. But yeah, I think that was the first one for a lot of people. Probably, yeah, loads of people that live in memory, really. Because I don't think we ever endured that in the 60s or the 70s. We never came anywhere near that close. I don't even think we came close to relegation, to be honest, even though
No, we
people
were
sort of say,
relegated in the 50s, but like
yeah, but
even
that was
then,
it.
back then, I don't feel like relegation was kind of like it was in the 90s or even now, where it's an abyss. And
No.
I think if Everton had gone down in 94, they'd probably have been okay. They'd probably have just got the stuff together, come back up. But I feel like if any of the relegation battles since then, particularly in 98, both 2022 and 2023, I think if they'd gone down in any of them, we'd be in like all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
Something like
You
gone
can't
down.
underestimate how much the game's changed in that like
No.
20 odd year period. It really is completely different. I mean, you can see on the pitch it's different, but everything around it is so much different. Like since the Premier League started and that money started to come into the game, you look at footage from the 80s and even early 90s, and there's like attendance is like 15,000 at Goodison. So it's like easy to forget how different the game was back then to the 90s. So, we were getting attendance of like 15,000 at times during the early 90s. And then, since the money's come into the game, and we've got the haves and the have-nots, and the gap is getting bigger and bigger. So it does feel like that if you get relegated now, and it was kind of getting that way towards the late 90s, if you get relegated now, it is like the end of the world. That's it. The club is doomed. Obviously, some clubs are prepared for it, but you get the feeling that Everton would never have been prepared for it. Like we touched on before, the Park End, it was built with relegation in mind. There's absolutely no doubt about that. That was probably the only bit of relegation planning that I think the club has ever done.
I never realised that, you know, Les. I'm really interested because I've never thought of that. I don't know why that
Yeah,
crossed my mind.
because it just wasn't in keeping with the whole rest of the ground, was it? We've got a
No.
whole two tiers round, three tiers. Have a one tier standard, Goodison. It's not great, that.
No, Joe, when you put it that way, it makes sense. I mean, I don't know if I thought because like the Kop was rebuilt around a similar time, wasn't it? I mean, it's bigger,
Yeah.
but that ended up being one tier, didn't it? Because they wanted that to be two tier, but they had to scale it back, didn't they?
Yeah.
They
And also, I think the cop, because that was a one tier stand, making a big one tier was all right.
Yeah, I get what you mean. The Park End
But
wasn't going to be a big one tier, was it? Because of the nature of how it was and stuff like that.
yeah.
It
But
was
yeah,
like.
it did feel at that point like, and I think because we were at the point then where you could see the money was drying up with Peter Johnson as well. And it just felt like, yeah, if we go down here, we're not coming back. We weren't that kind of club, and
No.
it felt like we could become something. Had Forest gone down by that point? I'm trying to think what teams have gone down.
Forest were down, but they come back up that season. So they were on
Oh
a
yeah. So
yo-yo club at that point.
Frank Clark was manager, wasn't he then?
Yeah.
Yeah, but we could have become one of those clubs. Wolves at the time, it would have been Wolves,
They were a
the big
championship
club.
side at the time, but big club.
Yeah. Went down, never came back. So yeah, that atmosphere, I never ever want to go through that again.
No,
I know
it was
we say this
awful.
every year, but it's just these last few years have been draining. Last year, in the end, we were fine by January, weren't we? Just would never, don't ever want to go through that again.
No, it's not nice, is it? And I remember like when you go back, when we go back to the Coventry game, you see like Le Bon was walking around the ground. There's that fella. Remember they had the fella on the front page of the Echo, and he was just crying. And he walked out the gate. He walked out the game and just stood outside the stadium crying because he just couldn't put himself through it anymore. He's just like, I can't watch
Yeah.
it. And they are the really tense affairs, and they're important days in our history, but they're not great days. And you touched on Frank Lampard there. I liked him as a fella. I think he bought into Everton, but I think you can only ride that so long. And I think one of the mistakes he actually made in his second season, so to speak, wasn't some. Obviously, he had a lot of tactical issues, but it was having them like, I don't know how much you had to do this, but having like when you see around Belfield, sorry, Finch Farm, even you'd see pictures of the Palace night, like it was an achievement. It's like, yeah, it was a great night, and it in terms of
Yeah.
being in the moment, but it's not an achievement for a club of our size and stature. And that's not to say, you know, with any sort of arrogance. It's just, but you look at the history of Everton, that's not a high point, is it?
No. No, and it never should be considered that. That those nights are, the club should never buy into that. So Palace wasn't a high point, but it was a great moment.
Yeah.
And just for the fans, though, for the fans to celebrate the fact that, God, we've stayed up.
Yeah.
Done it in some good style as well. As I say, yeah, you know, to be 2-0 down at half-time to win 3-2, you're going to be buzzing on after any game.
It's one of the most entertaining games, if you look at it now. Yeah. It's one of the most entertaining games you've got to see probably ever, possibly, because there was so much riding on it.
So for fans to be euphoric after that, there's nothing wrong with that, but the club should never celebrate it.
Yeah.
The club should have no sort of like anything to show that game and say like it was a good thing. There was a thing with Ken Wright, wasn't it? He had in his office the Echo after the 94 game, the Wimbledon 94 game. Add that up.
No, it's not an achievement. And I think Tony Cotty on the cost recently said he didn't, and I know he divides opinion locks on Evertonians. I think he's a bit of a hero of yours, or am I getting that wrong?
No, he sounded like Tony Cotty, yeah.
He said, like, for him, when Everton stayed up 94, I was like, I'm not celebrating that. This is Everton. They shouldn't be. And I think in 98, there was a bit of that. Like, Dave Watt, there was a bit of champagne I'd heard in 94 in the dressing room, but I remember Dave Watson speaking.
Howard Kendall was there, so that's
yeah. Yeah, well, there probably was. But I feel like, I know we talk about, I spoke to David Feely about this, and we talk about things repeating itself, but I feel like the mood music from people and players after Coventry is the same as after Bournemouth. Do you want to see the likes of Conor Cody going, that can't happen again? This, and
yeah, you
know, whatever, it wasn't everyone's cup of tea. I didn't mind myself, but is that, I think his attitude was spot on in that. This isn't something to celebrate in the long term. This is, and I do think that's where Coventry brought him, as you say, not just turning the ball, but the realization that he can't keep letting this happen. And then I feel like, weirdly, 1998-99 and 2023-24 have like some similarities in terms of, we struggle a bit, but we're okay. But generally, in the end, it's weird how it goes round, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is odd. It's not been a happy existence, has it? The last like
no
30 years or so. Well,
we're calling it good times, but that there's a reason. There's quotation marks around good times, not just because Bill said it, but it's questionable. So yeah, so 97-98. It was a tumultuous season, but we got through it, Les, and I think that's probably the most important thing, isn't it?
It is. As you know, as you say, relegation would have been unthinkable at that point. And we did get through it. And if you look what happened, and I'm sure this will be one of these subsequent episodes, what happened the season after, it actually wasn't a bad season, I don't think. We had a good summer that season.
Yeah,
that was the summer Walter Smith came in, signed some good players. So it's quite odd, the sort of bounce we had after that. When you consider the summer of 97-98, where we were probably in a better position than the summer of 98-99. We actually had a better summer the year after.
Yeah.
Which was really odd. I mean, I don't know, Walter Smith was a big pull at the time.
Yeah.
For those
players. He'd gone to Sheffield Wednesday. He was on his way to Sheffield Wednesday.
He was, yeah, yeah.
And
we got him in. So that made a huge difference.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, 97-98, we were sort of struggling to get anyone in.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a very, very tumultuous season.
Yeah.
Probably, and this sort of came up in the last couple of seasons, arguably the worst Everton team a lot of us have ever seen.
Yeah, I said that to David. I think we spoke about this, I think, on Twitter before. This is quite specific, but I remember you liking a tweet of mine, and the run hadn't quite set in, but when we lost to Watford under Benitez, I remember that being the first time in all years I've been to watch Everton since 97-98, I thought, that's that level. I'd seen bad, don't get me wrong, I'd seen stuff that I didn't like.
Yeah.
The first time I thought, it's Kendall Mark III territory. And that's, just before we finish up, that's one thing I do want to kind of touch on. I always feel it's a bit kind of sad it's not Howard's legacy, because Howard is the greatest of Evertonians. I think that's, well, if not the greatest, one of. But when I look back, I just feel really sad that someone who loved Everton so much and so integral to Everton's history, not carry the can for it, because, you know, Johnson and the myriad of circumstances involved, but the fact that he is kind of a figurehead during that milestone, it saddens me a bit, you know.
Yeah, it was a really sad way for him to bow out. Now, he said at the end of the season, this will never happen again when I'm here, but I think he probably knew he wasn't going to be there much longer anyway. But yeah, it was really sad. And, you know, don't forget during that season as well, we had the fallout with Gary Speed.
We did,
as well. that happened during that season, which, you know, which was it was a terrible way for a player of his ability and his stature to leave the club. Now, obviously, that's I don't know what the reason was. No one knows fully what the reason was, but it seemed like a fallout with Howard Kendall. There are all sorts of like rumors and theories about what happened.
There is, but it just seems like at the time I probably got whipped up and a lot of fans did. There was quite a bit of vitriol towards Speed, but when you look back now and you see people say, again, I don't know any specificity, so I'm not going to go, well, this happened or I heard this, but you get the vibe that actually Speed held his tongue because he loved Everton, because he didn't want to damage the club, and he's just kind of a bit like when Rooney left United. Although he's not a professional, like the club need the money or they need something, so I'm just gonna go now and take the hit on it.
Yeah, you did feel that with Gary Speed, but you know the club did a hit job on him at the time. The club put it all on him, and he's done that subsequently with a lot of players. It always comes down to the player wants to go. Now, Gary Speed was a wonderful professional footballer.
Oh, he's a brilliant pro. He plays for 11 years after he leaves Everton. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we lost him in his prime there.
Yeah,
you know he was a wonderful, wonderful footballer, and you could see that he would have had that professionalism about him that if he saw that the club wasn't getting run well and you know it was going off the rails and you know ironically he would have fitted in when Walter Smith was there. I think he would have fitted in there. Yeah. But yeah, for him to leave that season, that was a massive, massive black mark on that season because he was such a good player for us and, you know, top Evertonian. And yeah, we did give him stick. And it's not, I don't think it's something anything of us are proud of. But, you know, you can put that back on the club because if the club are saying, look, he wanted to go.
Yeah. He's refused to play at West Ham and stuff like that. They put that in the press or whatever. And people
exactly. Yeah. You know, and you can kind of see, you know, after he left, really, things properly did fall apart.
It did. And I think it's such a shame because actually, although we left, I quite like the player they bring in to replace him, although he's a very different player. I actually think he would have worked quite well with Don Hutchison.
Yeah.
I think he would have dovetailed really well, actually. I think Speed was, Speed was goal scorer as well. I think he was a bit more of an all-rounder than Don, but I think them as a two, they wouldn't have been, or in the midfield three, they would have worked quite well together.
Yeah, it could have been a great midfield. A lot of sliding doors moments with the toppies, aren't there?
Yeah.
Loads
of
them.
But yeah, it is. I mean, in this season as well, we talk about Ernie Pod, we have like the stuff with Ravenelli. You know, so there's about 10 seasons in one with this season. There's so much happening. You know?
It is. It was absolutely mad.
Like you and I,
as you said, you were what, 10 at the time?
I was 10, 11, yeah. And I think you and
I was 20. So
I might front the mailbag. Like one of the maddest things that even goes under the radar is that we had Graeme Stewart, he was a really good player for us, and we swapped him for Tyler and Ward.
Oh, God, yeah. But we got Danny Williamson this year as well, didn't we?
Yeah, with Runsworth. That was a swap deal as well, wasn't it? Because
did he play two games, if that?
I think he played a few in the first half of the season, but I actually think his last game is... sorry to give away the magic, listeners. We are recording this before the episode, so I will clarify. But I'm pretty confident his last game was that game you mentioned where Madar's wearing the yellow away kit with the blue...
Oh, right, okay, socks.
I think he got injured against Wimbledon in the build-up to Christmas, kind of makes a comeback in one game. And then just disappeared.
Yeah, I just never remember him playing at all. Yeah. It became a really bad squad.
It did. like his hairdresser said, it was curtains for him. Sorry for the joke.
Anyone hasn't seen Danny Williamson, go and have a look at him now.
Oh, yeah. Go. So, Les, you've been brilliant, fantastic value as ever. Obviously, we touched upon the Blue Room earlier. Just wanted to ask what you've got going on at the moment, what you want to plug, what's going on over there at the moment
on the Blue Room? Well, thanks for having me on, first of all. We've just got all the usual stuff. We've got I think we've got obviously the weekly subs, weekly mailbag. I'm doing Old New Borough Blue again. I think Dave's going to be starting up Diaries of an Old Lady again for the final season of Goodison. I'm going to be doing What's the Score again, which is like a very stat heavy preview show. Matt's going to have all his weekend previews. We're just kind of gearing up for the season starting again and the madness ensuing, and obviously we'll have all the post match stuff as well. But yeah, it's almost business as usual now.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this will be listening to Blue Room, but honestly, I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's a brilliant podcast. It's very popular, but with good cause. It's really, really good, and really enjoy listening to it. And anyone who hasn't, I would really recommend it. I'd particularly recommend the episode we're on, when Les was kind of to have a dog. But genuinely, it's really worth a listen. And as I say, you know, all do borrow blue with Les, particularly brilliant. The mailbag is so good. So honestly, do go and check it out if you can. And
Diaries of an Old Lady.
Of an Old Lady, yeah, sorry.
He did it a few years ago. I think he had Joe Royal on one of them.
He did. I remember listening to it in Croatia and being
really good.
It's brilliant content, guys. Honestly, you do check it out. Because
so I think we're going to be doing more of them over the coming season.
Definitely worth checking
out. What's going on?
And also, I know the lads are always in the Denby, so don't be afraid to say hi to them. They're a very approachable bunch. I know that much.
Yeah. And it's always quite surprising when someone recognises your voice. It's a bit like... Okay, fair enough. It's lovely, but it's quite disarming.
I haven't had that yet, but give it time. You never know.
Oh, you will, mate. Don't worry. You'll get it and you'll love it.
Great stuff. Well, Les, thanks as ever. I'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.